This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you need help bringing out the best in your pet's behavior, then give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And as always, we have another special topic to share. And what'll it be this time, Patricia?
You know, we've talked a lot on our show about how to read your dog's emotions by observing their facial expressions, right?
Right.
Body language. Well, now there's a new study suggesting that we can tell if our dogs are scared or happy based on the direction of the wag of their tail. So we're going to take a closer look at that in a little bit.
I am wagging my tail in anticipation.
It's very cute.
All right. We'll also talk to a documentary filmmaker and the subject of her film about the wild flock of cherry-headed conures that inhabit Telegraph Hill in San Francisco. That's still to come, but first, let's take some calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Doug from Avoca, Wisconsin.
Doug, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi. Well, I've got a couple of questions. We have a we would like to get a dog, and we've never had a dog before. And but we have a perennial nursery, and we do retail sales off of our property. And so we need kind of a sort of a retail friendly dog, and we need something that'll keep the deer away because we have a lot of display beds, and we have chickens, and yeah, we need something to kind of protect the farm, so to speak. We want something that won't wander away.
Avoid the chickens, chase the deer, and
greet the customers.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And you know we have customers that come out with kids. One breed that was sort of suggested was a Greater Pyrenees. By somebody, and I heard Trish that you own one.
I do,
and so I thought, well, it would be a great person to ask.
Sure. I do have some suggestions, and the first thing I want to say is your job description is ambitious.
Yeah,
you know, so I'm not saying that's not what you should go for, but do keep in mind that you're basically trying to hire three different positions here. A Pyrenees is a very reasonable dog to consider. They do tend to be quite territorial or protective of other animals. Less so with people, which is really, really good. There are other livestock guarding breeds. Actually, this is based on some research that was done by Dr. Green in Utah, who tested several different livestock guarding breeds, Anatolian Shepherds, etc., along with Great Pyrenees. And the reason I got a Great Pyrenees is because in his work, he found that Great Pyrenees, while being effective livestock guarding dogs, were also the friendliest to unfamiliar people.
Yeah.
So when I say livestock guarding dogs, I know your livestock is rooted rather than hoofed. But basically what they do is, and Tulip does this, my Pyrenees, is she barks at deer. Not quite the same way she barks at coyotes, but there's no deer who's going to come on the property when Tulip is there. She will bark at it. She will act as if it's a territorial intruder. So a Pyrenees is a good idea for that. They also tend to be quite alert at night, which is a good and a not-so-good thing. It depends on how much you like your sleep.
Yeah.
The one thing I worry about a Pyrenees, you can't leave a Pyrenees out at night and expect it not to wander.
Yeah.
So you're going to need some kind of a containment system, whether you just you know, bite the bullet and put a big, big, big fence around, or have your Pyrenees in the house and the windows open and hope that barking will keep the deer away, or use some kind of electric fencing system underground or overground, either way.
Okay.
And then, as important, no matter what breed you get, is getting a dog who, one, comes from parents who are very, very people-friendly.
Uh-huh.
And be very specific about that. Don't just say, are they friendly? You know, say, if there was a bone, there was a real bone. If there, you know, my dog found a deer bone in, you know, out in the field between the conifers, and a little kid came up, what would he do? You know, what would this dog do? So be very specific about the people friendliness of the parents, and then pick a puppy who seems to be particularly friendly based on the advice of the breeder.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Tricia, we received an email from Chris in Greenfield, Wisconsin, and he's wondering if you can answer this question for him. Here's what he has to say. Last week, my tortoiseshell cat named Shay was concentrating very hard when I came home. She couldn't be bothered to greet me, but she did meow. And when I located her, I saw she had a mouse cornered in one of the bedrooms and was staring it down. It disappeared by the time I'd located something to catch it with. Later that evening, I noticed that there was a multitude of mouse droppings in the bathtub, and if I'm guessing correctly, she used the tub as her own little torture chamber for the poor mouse.
Oh, dear.
A few days later, the mouse was dead. However, it seems that instead of eating the mouse or leaving it to lie around the house, my cat deposited the mouse in the toilet.
No kidding.
This isn't normal behavior for a cat, is it?
Well, not the last part, certainly. But, you know, the earlier parts are, and there are two things you bring up that are very typical. One is the not-so-pretty tendency of cats to play with their prey. There are lots of other animals who do that, by the way. There's a horrific sequence of killer whales playing with baby seal pups in which they toss them.
I saw that.
It's
hard to watch.
It's hard to watch. And it looks really gruesome, but there's some good theories, and there's some research actually done by Dr. Biben on play in cats specifically. And what he found was that cats who are even really, really hungry will play for relatively long periods with prey if the prey is large enough to be somewhat intimidating to the cat. So the belief is that this play is one of the ways that a cat has of disabling a prey animal before the killing bite, because rodents, as we know, can bite very, very hard.
Yes.
Very deep bites, very serious punctures that, as we also know, cats are very susceptible to getting abscesses and infections from puncture kinds of wounds, much more so than lots of other species. So probably the play that you're describing, torturous as it is probably an evolutionary adaptation to trying to disable the prey before the killing bite so the cat isn't actually injured. And then not actually eating it is very common, by the way. What we know is that cats come hardwired to kill small animals. That's one of the reasons they're a big problem with birds. Mm-hmm. When they're outside in the environment or in our yards, they don't need to learn to kill things. They just do. They have that hardwired. But you know what's not hardwired? Eating it. Their mother has to teach them. Their mother actually brings them disabled prey. It's not dead yet. Leaves it for the kittens and keeps bringing it back. If the kittens aren't quite able to contain it, she will eventually kill it if she has to. And then she will show them that you have to open up the package. That inside there's dinner in there. So again, what your cat is doing is very typical. Now here's the kicker: dropping it in the toilet. That's a first for me, and I'm sure for Larry. That's definitely, in all my 19 years of being an applied animal behaviorist, that's a first for me. And I say, sorry for the mouse, but here, what a nice cat to dispose of. Mine usually end up in the walls, you know, where you discover them a week later.
By smell.
Yeah. Yuck. So give that cat a treat.
And thanks a lot for sending that question. By the way, how do people email us?
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. Please send us an email, equally engaging, no doubt, to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Faith. I'm from Jacksonville, Florida.
Thanks for calling, Faith.
Thanks. I've got a couple of issues with my cat. Her name is Mouse. She's 6 years old. And the main issue is that she does not groom herself at all. She doesn't clean herself. She doesn't clean her bottom. I have to chase around the house with little pet wipes. We're building a new house, and my husband has put his foot down and said that the cat cannot come in the house because she's dirty. I'm not quite sure what to do about that.
I'm very concerned. Have you talked to your veterinarian?
I guess I haven't really talked to him about that specific issue. I do take her and get her bathed two or three times a year, which they have to put her to sleep for in order to bathe her and brush her and clean her.
She doesn't enjoy it, right?
No, and she's not, she's not nice to strangers. She'll trick you into letting her attack you. and he can't find any redeeming qualities between the aggression of strangers and the lack of grooming. to even keep the cat, and he doesn't understand my attachment to
her.
So
she's not
I need to make it to where they can live together with the grooming issue mainly.
She needs a publicist.
Yeah.
She needs somebody
she
to get a
daily
spin.
Groomer.
She needs a better spin on things here. Hey, listen, the reason I talked about your veterinarian, and that is without question one of the first things I would do, is a cat who is not grooming herself is not behaving normally. That is not normal behavior. And again, you, as we all know, I'm not a veterinarian. My PhD is in behavior, but what I can tell you is that in my experience, cats who don't groom themselves usually are not grooming themselves because of a medical issue. So this is a case where I would absolutely defer to your veterinarian. And you might want to look at it from a couple of different perspectives. One possibility is sometimes cats who don't groom their hind end especially, they have some kind of a pain issue.
Arthritis or something.
Arthritis. They have problems with their spine. So I would first go to my regular veterinarian and explain the problem, and any good vet is gonna be concerned as well. Because that's just not normal for a cat. There could be thyroid issues, all kinds of things it could be. Hormone, thyroid. So and then there's the issue of does it bother the cat to sort of turn around? Does she lick her paws? Does she groom her head? Does she groom any part of her body?
Every once in a while, I'll see her lick her paw and move her head once, but I don't really ever catch her bathing herself at all. And you can tell she doesn't because she's sandy and dirty, and when you touch her, you can feel it.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you, Patricia. You talk about certain things being hardwired and other things not. Is this one of those things that's not hardwired? Maybe her mom didn't teach her?
It is hardwired.
It is hardwired.
It's a very
good
question, Larry. It is. It's a great question. But as far as I know, it is absolutely hardwired.
Okay.
Yeah. And so one of the signs of a cat who is feeling poorly, who is in some kind of medical distress, is that they don't groom themselves. So something's wrong with your kitty. Yeah.
Get her to the vet.
Yeah.
And thank you very much.
And let us know.
Yeah,
let us know what your vet says.
Please do. And thanks a lot for calling, Faith. Appreciate it very much. Here's the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll discover if your dog is happy simply by observing the wag of its tail. I'm Larry Mehler with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Major support for Calling All Pets comes from Dog Tired, the home of American-made premium dog beds, featuring a build-a-bed option where customers choose shapes, fill, size, and fabric options. Designed and tested for man's best friend in Black Earth, Wisconsin. Dog Tired. Information at dawg-tired.com.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mehler with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time for this week's topic. Tricia, some new research says we can know if our dogs are happy by observing the direction a dog wags its tail.
Yes, there is some research published recently in the Journal of Current Biology that suggests that dogs wag their tails more to the right when they are happy and more to the left when they're fearful.
Well, it's strange that anybody would notice it, but when you think about it, it's simple enough to detect, I would expect.
Well, you would think it is, although the researchers are quick to point out that in most cases the difference is so subtle that you can't see it just by watching. They use slow motion video analysis. I should quickly add, though, that after learning about this, I was working with my young dog who is very much afraid of unfamiliar dogs, and darn if his tail wasn't significantly and obviously wagging more to the left. So that's just an observation.
Sure. But they had some research on this.
But it confirms the research. 30 dogs, they did this on 30 pet dogs. This is the University of Trieste. They analyzed the tail wags using video analysis. And what the analysis showed was that, yes, indeed, there was a significant trend towards right-handed wags, you know, a little bit more to the right than the left in response to dogs seeing their owners,
uh-huh.
and a little bit more to the left in response to an aggressive, unfamiliar dog.
Is there a logical explanation for the directional wagging?
Well, you know, the results are consistent with much of the neurobiological research on the lateralization of the brain. We know that the left side of the brain, for example, which controls the right side of the body, remember,
yeah. mm-hmm.
the left side of the brain is more active when people are happy, and the right side of the brain is more active when people are angry or fearful.
Mm.
Now, there's a lot of evidence that different sides of the brain in many, many contexts, in many ways, play different roles in behavior in lots of different species, and particularly in vertebrates, from fish to frogs to ferrets.
Mm-hmm.
There are examples all over the place. For example, both toads and baby chickens are more likely to avoid something that they see in their left eye rather than something that they see in their right. Isn't that interesting?
Fascinating. Why would the different sides of the brain do different things?
Well, you know, it's probably the same reason that it's useful to have members of a team take on different roles in some complicated project, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can get more done that way. And most importantly, each member can be better at something. If each team member specializes in something, so the brain is very similar. It has a lot to do, after all. So it's a benefit for different parts to specialize.
Boy, this is fascinating research. And it might help us understand what our animals are thinking and feeling, I guess. Are the researchers working on anything else?
They are. One of the researchers, Giorgio Valordegara, and his colleagues plan to look at how behavior is affected by smells received by the right or left nostril and visual signals received by the right or left eye.
The right or left eye.
Yeah.
Both my eyes are now on the computer screen, and I'm seeing calls.
And your tail is wagging,
and my tail to the right.
Oh, that's very cute. He's a happy guy.
And I tell you what, you can make our tails wag to the right by calling 1-800-462-7413. And as a matter of fact, let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Penny in Anchorage, Alaska.
Penny, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a dog I got at the animal shelter. He was about 10 months old, and I want to say he's got separation anxiety. I call it night anxiety.
What does he do? Be like a videotape for us.
Normally,
tell us.
He loves to sleep, and he loves to sleep at the end of my bed, and he's just a doll, and he won't sleep. He will jump down probably a dozen times over the 3 hours, paces, panting, heart racing, glazed over eyes, looking towards the windows. Will do everything he can do to get to the windowsill, knocking everything off like a lunatic through the house, waking everybody up. And there's nothing you can. The only thing I've learned that will help him is if I hold him tight and do like a kind of deep tissue massage.
Mm-hmm.
I can get him to calm down, but the minute I release him, it's back again.
Oh, you poor thing. There are two general categories that could explain what's going on. One is that this is basically neurobiological, or what some people would call psychological, but it still all gets back to biology, in that you're describing a dog who has some kind of phobia. You know, there's generalized anxiety, which can often be triggered by an imbalance of neurotransmitters in the brain, serotonin, for example, dopamine, GABA, some others. So it might be that this was initially triggered by a certain type of sound. And what happens in phobias is often the trigger becomes more and more generalized. The animal becomes what's called sensitized, meaning that a smaller and smaller trigger, like if it was a noise, it can be a quieter and quieter noise, or it can be any kind of, it starts out as one type of noise, and then it can become any kind of a noise at a certain time of the night. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that it's a medical problem, and it's related to some kind of a disease state or an injury, whether it's pain-related. Pacing and panting is highly correlated with pain, with intense pain.
You know, I wonder, because he's not satisfied just to lay down.
Yeah.
He keeps coming up towards me, and he's like on me.
Oh.
He'll come up on my head.
Yeah.
And I get the sense he's trying to get me to help him.
Right. I would start with going to your veterinarian and doing all the classic things your vet's going to do, and I'll leave that to your vet. But I mean, I would have, you know, I would ask my vet to run a full chemistry panel, and I wouldn't have to ask him because he'd do it, you know, he'd do it without blinking. I would consider talking to your veterinarian about trying pain medication just to see if some kind of pain medication, if your vet felt it was safe, that if that would help. And it might be that the dog has some learned cognitive behavior that was initially caused by some kind of medical problem. But I would very strongly urge you to get a full medical workup, because I think this would be a case of having a behaviorist and a veterinarian working together for you.
Would be best.
Okay.
Good luck. Thanks, Penny, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Tough one. 1-800-462-7413, our number. You know, we received an email question from Janet in Iowa, Patricia, and here's the problem she's having. She says, I have 7 border collies, and they're all quite well-behaved for the most part. We give demonstrations to bus tours and local groups who are interested in watching border collies, herd sheep.
Yay!
Yay, yeah. The only problem she has is when all of the dogs are out and someone drives up the driveway. She finds it very difficult to keep them all from wanting to rush to the visitor and greet the visitor with happy barks, jumps, and kisses. The UPS man literally flies into his truck.
As a matter of fact.
And this isn't as much of a problem if only 3 of the 7 dogs are outside when someone comes, but if they're all outside, one dog will run toward the visitor and the rest follow, of course. And I know to keep some of the dogs inside when I'm expecting a visitor, but what should I do when an unexpected visitor approaches the driveway? Probably there, something before that person gets
right,
there, my guess
right.
is.
There is a real group effect in dogs as well as people. You know, it's true. And 7 dogs can excite each other so easily. That kind of arousal tends to be so catching. And so I hear you loud and clear. I had 7 dogs once too. It's a pretty big pack, especially when they're high energy dogs. But here's the great news. One is the breed. Some breeds, individuals of some breeds, are easier to train to stop when running than others. Yay, border collies are one of them. And two, you work them on sheep. And if you work your dogs on sheep, you absolutely have to have a flying stop. If you work dogs on sheep, you have to be able to stop them when they're running, either on an outrun, around a big circle to get to the back, they're moving towards you, it doesn't matter, you have to be able to stop your dog. So here's what I want you to do, is you just need to practice in the context in which you need it. Start one at a time. So I don't know what your signal is, let's say it's lie down. Rather than saying lie down when they're running around to work sheep, I want you to have friends help you. I want you to start first. Actually, you don't need a friend to begin with. I want you to go to the exact place where the general area, I should say, where they're going to be when people drive up, and you're going to let them start moving away from you, and you're going to say lie down. You're going to reinforce them any way you want, ball play, often very effective for border collies, whatever the dog absolutely adores. You might even say okay and let them up and go run to a visitor once you start doing with visitors. But so first start with no visitors in the location where you need it, one dog at a time. And what you're going to build on is you're going to add numbers of dogs. It's going to be 1 dog, then 2, then 3, then 4. And when you practice with all 7 there, I don't want there to be a visitor. I just want them to be in the yard just doing what they're doing, and I want you to say lie down. And once you can get that, then you can start having visitors come up. Now, when you have visitors come up, you're going to want to have just 1 dog out, 2 dogs out. But in other words, you're going to teach this in location and in context and just go slowly and build up the foundation, the same one you had to build up when you were working sheep. Just build up slowly to make it a little harder and a little harder and a little harder so that they can go from kindergarten to graduate school.
And you're obviously a good trainer. People come to see your dogs. Sounds like the perfect solution to me.
You have all the tools you need in your toolbox. You just need to put them together the right way. Good luck.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Annie.
Hi, Annie. Where are you from?
West Palm Beach, Florida.
And what can we do for you?
Okay, well, thank you so much for taking my call,
sure.
First of all. My husband and I and our 14-year-old son adopted a 3-month-old orange tabby kitten who's adorable. His name is Ed. And he seems to have formed a very strong bond with me, but he's a little bit timid with my husband and my son. And I was wondering if there was anything that we could do to get him to share the love a little bit more with them.
Sure. There are a couple things that can be done. And one is anti-intuitive. One is to have your husband and son not try.
Okay, not try.
The more people try to make friends with a cat, most cats tend to pull away. Hard to get works on cats as well as dating. So this is good practice for your son.
Not for your husband.
Not for your husband, right. right. Different stages of life here. Okay. But so one of the things that cats are very resistant to, and by the way, there are quite a few species, companion animals, I'm thinking of specifically now, like dogs and cats, who tend to be more afraid of men than they are of women. And it's not because men beat them or tortured them in some previous life or earlier when they were little kittens. It's because of the way men are built. It's because they move differently. It's because their voices are deeper. Their jaws are bigger. So it's not necessarily anything that happened to this cat. Sometimes I think it's just an sort of instinctual or inherent response to differences, to secondary sexual characteristics.
Okay.
So, one, is your husband and your son do not want to go after your cat or reach their hand out. They should be playing hard to get. What I would suggest to them is that they carry around little packages of the best food in the world, and your cat gets to define what the best food in the world is. My cat would say it's cantaloupe, believe it or not.
That's
not
strange.
Yes, it's very, cats are on this earth to not follow the patterns that we expect them to follow, right? So let your cat tell you what he or she, or he, Ed, really, really loves, and then your husband and son should basically sort of toss it around. I'm thinking of a flower girl, but don't say that to them because, you know, they won't like that. That won't sound very masculine. And the idea is that the cat is going to learn to associate those two men with wonderful things falling from the sky. And then they can start dropping this food closer and closer to them. Then they can sit down on the chair, put a little piece of food on their knee, and not reach out to pet the cat. Let the cat move to them. The cat I have now, Sushi, was not affiliative in any way, not to anybody, not to men, not to women. You could pick her up, and she was very docile, but she never wanted to cuddle. She never came over. And so I basically just started shaping approach is when she would come closer to me, I would give her a little, I would drop an extra good piece of food. And eventually before I put her dinner down, she would circle. And when she got just closest to me, I would put her bowl down. And after 3 months, she actually would rub against me for just the tiniest little millisecond. Now she slept with me all night last night, cuddled up against my legs.
Yeah.
So try that kind of routine with her, okay?
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Coming up next, learn about wild parrots. The wild parrots of Telegraph Hill, as a matter of fact. We'll welcome a documentary filmmaker and an author to talk about these special birds. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with advice from Patricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with a multi-dog household or you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, you can find the information you need online. For a selection of books and training guides available for purchase, call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or log on to our website, callingallpets.org.
How long have you owned these?
Oh, I don't own any of them, actually. They're all wild.
Another one over there. If you stop feeding them, would they, like, move? I mean, go someplace else, or?
Yeah, they wouldn't have any problem at all. They eat a lot of fruit, and they eat, like, little nuts, and they eat... They eat pine cones. Most of their day is spent eating and playing.
So they'd be all right. If you weren't feeding them, if you weren't taking care of them, they could exist by themselves in the wild.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Got it.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and that was a clip from the documentary titled The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. It's a film about a flock of wild parrots who've settled in the waterfront area of San Francisco. And today we're joined by the subject of the film, Mark Bittner, and the film's director, Judy Irving, to tell us more about the wild parrots of Telegraph Hill. Thank you both for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Hi. Pleasure.
Mark, where did the birds come from, and how did they get to Telegraph Hill?
Originally, they're from the southwest corner of Ecuador and the northwest corner of Peru. That's their native territory. And prior to 1992 or 93, that general area, it was legal to go down there, capture birds, although technically Ecuador didn't allow it, but Peru did. And there was smuggling from Ecuador. But they were captured and brought up here, put in quarantine. They're given quarantine bans and then sent on into the pet trade. How exactly they got from that point into the city, I don't know. There were around at least six birds started this flock, and they all did not start at once. It was a gradual accumulation.
Judy, what inspired you to make a documentary out of this story?
Well, actually, when I first met Mark, I saw him feeding sunflower seeds to some parrots on the Greenwich Steps in San Francisco, and I asked myself, how much story can there be in a guy feeding a bunch of birds? But it's a story that people can relate to on a lot of different levels. It's not just about the birds. It's not just about Mark. It's about consciousness. It's about a kind of consciousness that we share with animals. And it's about death and lots of things. So it's sort of surprising for people when they go see it. It's different.
It's funny, too.
And it's got all those, it's all a range of emotions. And one of the birds that I've found fascinating to see and to hear described was Connor. And we have a film clip from the film in which you describe Connor, of course, one of the birds in the flock. And let's take a listen to that clip.
Connor's a different species than the other birds in the flock. He's a blue-crowned conure. His personality is a lot different than the cherry heads. They're really hot, feisty birds. And Connor is really cool and quiet. He's also kind of cranky. Actually, he's very cranky, aren't you, Connor? But that's because he doesn't have a mate. He's not treated well by the others. But it's interesting because he's been out in the flock longer than any of them.
You know, Mark, you go on to say that Connor wasn't particularly friendly to you, right? And when he was given the option to stay inside with you or to be wild, he chose to be outside. And it made me curious. Why did you have so much patience for Connor? What made him so special to you?
There was just something regal about him. And it's one thing that's kind of interesting. There was a woman who was, she didn't feed them by hand, but she had a bird feeder. And I met her after I was well into this, and she was taking notes on the birds, and her observations of Connor were identical to mine. There was something sort of magnificent but also lonely about him. And he had been a pet for a period of time. I mean, he started out as a wild bird. He had a quarantine ban like the others, but I don't know. It's one of those things you have to see him, know him, know his way to appreciate what he was all about. And I just, you respected him. He had this aura where you didn't dare violate his respect.
Well, I mean, you didn't have formal training, at least at the start, with your work with these birds. And
they taught me.
That was my question. How did you learn to care for these birds, really?
Well, in the beginning, I just didn't do anything that they didn't want me to do. I didn't take any liberties at all. And then, as you know, it's like most friendships. Once you start to know each other a little bit, you start, you know, being a little less formal. So, you know, I read a lot, but mostly it was just, you know, interacting with them and seeing what they wanted. And never, I mean, I wanted their trust. The only way you can get their trust is by being consistently over and over and over again trustworthy and not violating that trust in any way.
And so you were caring for them in a way, although they would, as you had said earlier, they would make it fine on their own. So
yes.
I would love to hear you talk about what you think kept you and the individuals of the flock together. You know, what was the bond that
food? That's what they wanted from me, was food. And I think after a while, I mean, they got some pleasure out of interacting with me. I was kind of unique. You know, they would pull on my hair with their beaks and stuff. But I was not allowed to pet them or anything like that. There were rules. I stayed with it because I fell in love with them. You know, it's funny, while I was doing it, I was always very, I was always asking myself, why am I doing this? I mean, I was so deeply involved in it, and it was just something that sort of started as a lark, really. It was just entertainment, and it kept getting deeper and deeper. So from my end, I fell in love. From their end, essentially, it was food. They love sunflower seeds. It's not really good for pet parrots especially, but they can't get it naturally. They love the fat in them. I'm sort of like their French fry stop, I think.
But when you started taking care, what compelled you to start taking care of the wild birds in the first place?
I was just fascinated. I didn't know anything about birds. I wasn't even sure they were parrots at first. You know, it's like maybe they were some, as I say in my book, California species that I'd never seen before or something. I didn't know anything about them. But they were fascinating to me. And so I went out looking, you know, for information on them. Nobody knew anything, but I was able to verify that they were parrots. And I went, you know what? Wow. how is this happening? Nobody knew anything. Nobody was studying them. And it was really just a matter of curiosity. And I wasn't doing anything else at the time, in a way. I was mulling over my life, trying to figure out what to do. And a lot of the time, I was afraid that they were a distraction, that I was wasting time by spending so much time with them. And as a matter of fact, they did change the whole course of my life, but definitely for the better.
Well, and Judy and Mark both, actually. Speaking of changing your life for the better, these birds ultimately brought you two together, right?
Yes, indeed, they did. That usually we reserve that as a surprise, but the film's been out for so long now that I guess the cat's out of the bag.
You're busted, you guys.
Well, did the birds teach you anything, Judy?
I learned a lot about flock behavior, and I learned a lot about how flock behavior is very similar to human social interactions. For instance, they all fly in together, they look beautiful, and then as soon as they land, they start squabbling. and just, you know, like Mark did, I learned lessons about consciousness. They fear injury. They fear death just like we do. There's this big wide world out there of consciousness which is not human. And I think if people were aware of it, it would make them less lonely. I'm sure that the folks who listen to your show know exactly what I'm talking about because they're all very aware of the consciousness in animals. But lots of people are not, and particularly people who live in cities tend to forget that. So that was another thing that the parrots taught me.
We have one more clip from the film, just a short clip. Let's listen to that clip.
There's a story that Suzuki Roshi told. He was the Zen master at the Zen Center here in San Francisco. He went to Yosemite, and he sees this big waterfall coming over this cliff. And it's one river at the top of the cliff, but as it falls, the river breaks up into all these individual droplets. And then it hits the bottom of the cliff, and it's one river again. We're all one river until we hit this cliff. That distance between the top of the cliff and the bottom of the cliff is our life. And all the individual little droplets think they really are individual little droplets until they hit the bottom, and then they're gone. But, you know, that droplet doesn't lose anything. It gains. Against the rest of the river.
Mark, how's the flock doing now?
They're thriving. They're doing quite well. I mean, when I left, there were around 60, and today there are around 200. It's impossible to know the exact population. You know, they have problems like other birds. They're out in the wild. They get diseases. Hawks get them. But that's nature. I wouldn't, you know, give them any kind of special privilege or something like that. Nature can be really brutal in a lot of ways, or that's how it appears to us at least. But, I mean, basically they're doing the same as any other bird. I mean, in some ways maybe better because they're really, you know, loved. There are people looking out for them.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk with both of you and to see your film. Thank you both so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Judy Irving is the director of the film, The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. Mark Bittner is the subject of the film and the author of a book with the same title. They joined us today from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Patricia's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Major support for Calling All Pets comes from Dog Tired, the home of American-made premium dog beds, featuring a build-a-bed option where customers choose shapes, fill, size, and fabric options. Designed and tested for man's best friend in Black Earth, Wisconsin. Dog Tired. Information at dawg-tired.com.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call. Here's the number. It's 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Patricia's book, For the Love of a Dog, Understanding Emotion in You and Your Best Friend. So here's today's question. For wild parrots living in San Francisco, one might guess there are a lot of obstacles in the way of survival. Turns out the relatively cold San Francisco temperatures haven't affected the flock so far. Rather, the flock remains vigilant of natural predators despite its urban surroundings. What is the cherry-headed conure flock's primary natural predator? Again, if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413 and check out our website in about a week to find out the answer. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. And now it's time for some more calls. Here's the number again, 1-800-462-7413, and here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Kevin from Hampton, Virginia.
Kevin, hi. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have an 18-month-old Akita puppy, and we've been having some problems getting her house trained. She, from the very start, she had problems in terms of, keeping, even when she was crated, she would foul the back of her crate, even if we only left her in there for 10 or 15 minutes. And I think that she may have been just left there, you know, for long periods before the previous owners decided to turn her over to the SPCA.
So she just learned to go wherever she lay, probably.
Right. She no longer pees in the house, at least. And if we crate her, she will not go in her crate.
Good.
But, it seems as though if we leave the house for a little bit, even if she's been out very recently, she will just find a convenient spot, none in particular, and she will go and leave us with a big present. She's at 80 pounds or so. She needs large presents.
Right. This is a big gift. Well, you know, there are a couple of things that could be going on. If she does it consistently or often when you leave, it is one symptom of separation anxiety.
Well, in this particular case, what we do first thing in the morning, I let her out. And a lot of times, if, you know, we're still there for another half hour, 45 minutes, she'll come in, she'll go to the bathroom while we're there in the house.
She will, okay.
As I said, you know, she'll run around outside for 15, 20 minutes and come back in and then go, oh, I have to go to the bathroom.
Right.
And, you know, wherever
right.
that happens to be, it's funny, we're always out of sight, but it's almost as though, I don't know, it seems she's got plenty of opportunity to go. And I just I'm just not sure how to encourage her to do it outside any more than I am.
And the first thing I would say is not that you are necessarily, but I would be sure not to attribute this to some kind of spite or strategic revenge or something like that. Sometimes it looks like that and it might feel like that. But what often happens is even dogs who had very normal, good upbringings, especially when they're relatively young, they're just so excited, distracted.
Right.
You know, there's just so much to do, and there's the squirrel smell, and there's the this, and there's the that. And so they get really distracted, and then they come back and it's like, oh, yeah, I had to go to the bathroom.
Right.
So I would definitely put it on cue. So I want you to be outside with her almost as if she was a puppy. And I'm hoping are you giving her a great food reward when she defecates outside?
We've been verbally praising her, but we haven't been giving her food.
Okay, up the stakes. I want her to be like, oh, I can't believe I've trained them to give me a piece of turkey. If I just defecate outside, because I have to do that anyway, but they apparently don't know that. And so if I go to the bathroom outside, they'll give me a piece of turkey. This is so cool. So definitely up the ante, because what you're doing is not working, right? Obviously,
right.
It's helping, but you're not quite done yet. So go outside with her. and then watch her. And when she starts, every dog tells us, you know, when they're about to get ready to defecate, as she's about to do that, say, hurry up, or whatever you want to say, or please, whatever you want to say. And then as soon as she's done, don't interrupt her. Don't say anything while she's going. As soon as she's done, I want you to say, good girl, even if you're 20 feet away, good girl, and then give her a food treat. So she's like, cool. This is so cool. If she doesn't go outside, if she doesn't defecate when you're outside, then keep her with you at every second and then go back outside and keep doing that. And I'll bet you that will just get everything going in exactly the right direction.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Liberty from Hyattsville, Maryland.
Thanks for calling, Liberty. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm calling because I want to foster a healthy relationship between my 12-month-old daughter and my 3-year-old Jack Russell mix. Our dog is very friendly to people in general, but he has this one little quirk. He does get a little bit cantankerous if he's, like, laying in his favorite spot and, say, you want to get him up off of the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you tell him to get off the couch, and he won't, and then you tell him again, and he growls, and then if you physically remove him, he'll nip at you.
Okay.
And so I wanted to find out, is there anything I can do to discourage that behavior? I'm trying to teach her, you know, how to, you know, cope with him, but I'm just afraid that I'm never going to be able to turn my back on him.
And you might not ever be able to. And I hate to say that, but it's just true. And I'll tell you, one of the things that professional dog trainers and behaviors are consistent about, and we're not consistent about a lot of things. We tend to have a lot of different viewpoints about a lot of different things.
Uh-huh.
But there's a lot of consistency among the belief that there are many, many, most dogs, as a matter of fact, you just simply don't leave them with children without...
Yeah.
Without a tremendous amount of management and oversight. Now, that said, I too am also concerned about the potential, especially as your daughter gets older. You know,
right.
It's 5-6-year-old kids who are the most often bitten, by the way.
Uh-huh.
They're just sort of that age. They don't have a lot of emotional control, but they're getting pretty mobile.
Right.
And they start to want the world to go the way they want the world to go, which is pretty much how your Jack Russell is going to be for the rest of his life.
Right, exactly.
So there are a couple things to do besides the management and sort of never expecting that you're going to be able to just let them alone to work things out.
Right.
So what I would start doing is teaching him to get off the couch to a cue. Turn this into a game. Jack Russell's love tricks.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the perfect clown circus dog. They're really smart. They love to do tricks. So I would start teaching him something like get off or, you know, jump down or maybe jump down. That's sort of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't use any words that you've used in the past. I would use a new one, maybe jump down.
Mm-hmm.
But before I said that, I would wave the treat in the air, not you know, a couple feet away from his nose, and just look for that nose to go up, you know, look for him to connect with that line of molecules going between his nose and the food, and then start waving it around. And just as he's about to get up, I would say, jump down. And as soon as he starts to move, I want you to praise him with your voice. Good dog. And then he gets the treat.
Okay.
So that I would use that method on any circumstance where he's like, don't bother me now.
Right.
You know, so maybe it's get back or get off or come over here or jump down or even having somebody reach towards him and pet him while he's sleeping or napping, you know, sort of dozing, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And we're already doing, you know, some of the conditioning you've mentioned in previous shows, the eyes. Like, he's bad with other dogs, so we've been doing eyes and trying to keep him focused on the treat and not on the other dogs, and that seems to be working, so.
Good. You might want to connect to somebody local could come in and be a coach. It's really helpful with kid and dog's issues. You know, these are pretty serious things, and we don't want your child bitten, so you might want to connect and get a coach because, you know, the best tennis player in the world has one, so
<That's>
why not?
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You know, Tricia, a few weeks ago, I wrapped up the show by asking you where the old legend about elephants being afraid of mice, where that came from.
Yes, did somebody? Yes?
Well, yes. Our listeners came through for us again. We heard from Bob in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And he referred us to the website Snopes.com. It's a popular website for debunking urban legends. And according to Snopes, there's nothing about rodents that elephants find particularly frightening, given their large size and relatively poor eyesight. Elephants don't necessarily even notice the occasional mouse.
That makes sense.
Yeah, scurrying around them all that often, you know. But Snopes says if there's any truth to the legend, it likely comes from elephants being anxious about nearby sounds or movements that they can't identify, maybe like those caused by mice darting around underfoot. So it's
okay, so somebody just made this guess up is what it basically what it sounds like.
It was perfectly made up.
But it's a reasonable guess, but it's, you know, pretty much a guess, I would say.
What I like about you, never make your suggestions up. That's what I like about you.
I know everything. No. At least I say when I'm just making a wild guess, I always say, right?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's been a great show. Thank you very much, Patricia. Thanks for listening to us. And let me remind you that Patricia McConnell has some great credentials. She's a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist, and she's an adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's also here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer, Cynthia Schuster. And Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.